Hi, this is Marcus Forderer, and you're listening to the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey, Ben Rock, how you doing?
Happy, still New Year. I don't know. Is it that, are we in the Larry David zone of like, it's too late to be still saying Happy New Year?
I don't know. It's only the 7th. So it's, it's been a week, I suppose. So Happy New Year. Yeah.
Still Happy New Year. I hope your New Year is happy. Next week, I could give a crap about your year.
Yeah. Next year, everything changes. Next week, everything. In fact, tomorrow, everything changes. It's just, it's no longer New Year's. It's kind of like still having your Christmas lights up in February.
Yeah. I'm one of those people. It's like, I'll leave my Halloween decorations up until, the summer, but take that Christmas crap down on January 1st.
All right. So Ben, who is on the show today?
It's a great show. We have Marcus Forderer. It's his first time on the show, but he's actually listened to the show before. It always blows my mind when someone who I'm like excited to talk to, who's got an amazing body of work, has actually even heard of our show. Marcus has listened to the show, and he shot September 5, which is a really cool, to say docudrama. When I say docudrama, it makes it sound boring. It is not boring. It's about the Munich Olympics in 1972, and it follows the sportscasters inside the studio and around the studio when those Munich Olympics became a terrorist event.
Oh yeah,
okay. And and suddenly sportscasters had to make hard news decisions, like if we film out this window, are we about to see somebody get shot, and is that going to be broadcast around the world? And it was the first Olympics that happened in Berlin since World War II. It was like Germany trying to say, hey, we're all friends again, right? And it was, I think, also the first Olympics that were internationally broadcast, period. And they were using kind of new technology. But Marcus is fascinating. And the approach that they took to, that he and the director took to the material, I think is great. But also he talks about stuff that, like, to me, maybe is a little bit less exotic than it is to you. Like disassembling zoom lenses and messing with the elements to get certain specific effects that he wanted the lenses to create.
Sure. Yeah.
And, he openly says, like, I do not recommend anyone do this. Like he only had 2 weeks of prep and he lost a whole day to figuring out how to put his lens back together.
But, yeah, that's true. But, that's a thing.
But like, I gotta say, like, I use cameras, I use lenses all the time. Do I know what any part of them do? I don't, not at all.
And it doesn't surprise me at all that Marcus went down this path, but it also doesn't surprise me that he lost a ton of time trying to put it back together, because they can be quite complicated on the inside. And most of our listeners might be surprised to know how much glue is actually holding things together. So you have to remove glue and replace glue. It's a whole thing.
And now, close focus.
Yeah, well, anyway. Great interview, but this actually kind of dovetails into what we were going to talk about, because we're still sort of in that moment in the year where, like, movies are coming out, but, like, all the studios have put out their big Oscar contenders. They had to be out before January 1st, so they're kind of still trickling out into more mainstream releases, some of them. And Sundance doesn't start, I guess, for another couple of weeks. And I feel like there really isn't news. And we were thinking it might be interesting to take this breath. And since we have you as the co-host and you're kind of an expert in camera and lens and lighting technology, to kind of say, like, what do you see coming down the pike this year? We're not asking you to violate any NDAs you might have with major manufacturers, but like where are we going sensor wise? Where are we going lens wise? Where are we going gear wise, as in the cinematography world, what do we have to look forward to in 2025?
That's a great lead in, Ben. I'm going to say that, we're going to have more of the same. I think we're going to have more of the same. We're going to see incremental improvements in all of the areas that you just described. And I already do know that there's some stuff coming that is kind of exciting. That is going to, you know, people are going to get excited about. What I will say, though, what I do want to talk about, I think is maybe a little bit less obvious. And that is, I think that 2025 will actually be a turning point for some people in gear. And the technology that they use for motion pictures and for television and for the sort of emerging social media web-based, you know, self-produced home content. I hate to use the C word, but I don't really know what else to call it right now because I think that a lot of it is sort of nebulous and undefined. I got to spend a little bit of time on the set of a dear friend of yours and mine, Liam Finn. He was producing a 87-minute feature film that's vertical, which is following a format from China. And I think that which has now become a thing, or they're trying to make become a thing here, where you get to see like the first maybe 20 pages of the script essentially. But then if you want to complete the thing, there's little like pay windows that you have to pay a certain small transaction to continue the story. And I think that we're going to see more forms of entertainment, some that are clearly being used overseas right now and elsewhere. But what I really think is interesting about technology is that it seems to me that the idea of this like Netflix approved sort of like standard that so many people have held to as like a watermark saying this is acceptable or this is not acceptable, I think that's going to go away. I think that people are actually going to start trusting their eyes for the first time in a very long time. In fact, I would say I probably wouldn't think that that this sort of moment has happened since the era of film. In film, people very much trusted their eyes and they said, this looks good to me, this is appropriate. But I think that there's a whole new wave of tools, a new wave of production products that are specifically going to be not necessarily the highest performing, but they're going to look really, really acceptable, really, really good to a level of people who are doing what it is and they trust their eyes. I'm already seeing this sort of at the low end, and I'm seeing it with people who are buying older technology and saying, this looks great to me, and specs be damned. I don't think that that's totally going to exist on the highest end, of course not, because there is so many really high-end products. But what I'm really thinking is that, you know, similar in the way that people are messing with lenses right now, that is completely an aesthetic choice. That is something that they are doing so that they can change the look of what's being captured, even if it is not actually going to be more resolute or more dynamic range or not going to achieve a higher spec. They're doing it for an aesthetic choice. I think
sensors are so clean that it's kind of making it's like the old Nine Inch Nails song. I hurt myself just to see if I could still feel like let's degrade the image so that we feel like we're looking at anything anymore and not just the most perfect digital representation of what the cleanest lens will give us. If we want to actually feel something, let's use this as an artistic tool and not as the perfect recording device.
You know, I think there's an awful lot of extremely high quality stuff that's come out recently that is also at more modest budget. I think we're going to see a lot more of that stuff. Stuff that is like particular lens manufacturers, and I'm not going to name any of them because they're not sponsors of the show, but there are some brands out there that are making some very
so now they know how to get you to name them. Go on.
Well, actually, I can name check Laowa, who is a sponsor of the show, and they're doing incredibly high performance lenses at really sort of like rock bottom prices. And I know some people will say like $3,000 isn't a rock bottom price, but
for a good lens,
for like a really respectable lens, especially a cinema lens.
You could go get whatever still photography lens you wanted and get a usable image, but it just depends on what kind of shoot you're doing and how much bullshit you're willing to put up with from that lens that's not being used the way it was designed.
So what I think is really interesting, though, is that I think there's going to be people who are really trusting their eyes, people who look at a project and go, that was great, that had a great look, And the technology that they used for that is going to be acceptable for whatever I'm doing, especially people who are working in the web. I don't anticipate radical changes for the people who are working in reality or documentary. I think that the camera systems, primarily Canon in that sort of space, are going to continue to dominate. I think this is really interesting. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff being done in lighting. I happen to know that there's something that is going to be announced, or is going to have its first public debut, which I actually can talk about a little bit here in this segment, at the Local 80 Grip Tech Expo on January 18th. So if you're in Los Angeles and go to the Grip Tech Expo at Local 80, which I know you can currently RSVP for free. We'll put a link to it in the show notes over at Cam Noir. There's a new reflector product that is not trying to be the traditional sort of reflectors. So it is not a super hard, shiny surface that moves the most amount of photons as possible into another area. And it's not a white or other sort of fill bounce material, a Griflon or an Ultra Bounce, where it's really about kind of casting a huge, wide, white sort of soft reflection. It fits in the middle. And in this regard, it's unique. It's the Betty Luminous Flux system. And the Betty Luminous system, which I have some involvement with, and so I'm able to talk about it. I'm going to go to the tech and the expo and be there. But it is the first reflector system that is 100% tuned and adjusted to be as flattering as possible to people. Does it make it the most efficient? No. Is it totally neutral and has no color shift? Yes, it is an ideal reflector. It actually attenuates a little bit of infrared when you're working outside, because there's a lot of infrared that comes from the sun. And it has a very clever specular distribution system so that talent, when they're being lit by this reflector, don't feel like they're under the microwave oven as some other sorts of reflectors are. Like, if you've ever been lit by a checkerboard on a sunny day, it can really feel intense. It can be like, you know, eye-watering, squint-inducing. And this new reflector system doesn't do that. As a matter of fact, it's really comfortable to have that reflector even in your eye line and talk to someone without feeling like you're on fire. So the Betty Luminous system is, I'm personally biased, but I think it's really going to be revolutionary. And I've had some conversations with a couple of DPs who are taking it for shoots this month. And it's going to be available for pre-order, hopefully at the same time as the Cinetech Expo. I think we're going to put a link up on hotrodcameras.com, and there should be an official website by then. But it's a thing that's been coming around for 4 years. I expect to see more stuff like this, where it's going to be tools that have very specific purposes. If you want to make someone look good, that's what this is about. But I expect more tools to be used for very specific purposes that other tools haven't gotten to in the past, or have been little bits of compromises. I expect to see more things sort of slotting in. I know some of the lighting manufacturers are looking at some very creative, interesting stuff for 2025. So I don't expect that to slow down anytime soon. I mean, really, it's in some ways, it's a golden age of filmmaking gear. It is a golden age of technology. Oh, yeah. The post-production processes have never been faster. Storage has never been cheaper for your data. And frankly, with, you know, the new 28 days or 28 years later movie coming that was all shot on an iPhone, or mostly shot on an iPhone, I believe that there's going to be perhaps a renaissance of people feeling like, hey, this is what I've got. This is what I'm going to go forward with. And there'll be less conversation about what particular tech was used there and more what the workflow was to actually get someone to the finish line. Because all the tools just keep getting cheaper and better, I think you're going to see a rise of indie film again. I think you'll see a rise of indie, you know, web-related content. Man. It's going to be boring. Yeah, it won't be boring.
Yeah. So, on the flip side, I just want to make a prediction myself for 2025, and that's that I think that we're going to, as a culture, realize that AI is awesome and also not great for making entire projects.
I'm going to interrupt you for a second here. I saw someone who posted an update of the Will Smith eating spaghetti, which went around, of course, which looked horrific. And now there's a better version of Will Smith eating spaghetti. It's still so uncanny valley and weird. And do we really want to make Will Smith eating spaghetti like our litmus test for whether or not AI is acceptable?
I don't know if you've seen it. There's a short film called The Heist. that a producer I'd worked for on an action-related project sent it to me, and he said it. And he just sent it to me, and he said, "It's over, like filmmaking is over." And I watched this thing, and I'm like,
"Was it boring as f?" Yeah,
it looks like a very pro forma car chase scene, and
from a video game cutscene.
Yeah. It's great if you don't care if the car is the same from shot to shot, if it's okay if the characters run like Steven Seagal or run like if Steven Seagal was a Boston Dynamics robot.
Yeah.
If everything is constantly inconsistent, and I'm watching it and I still circle around the same problem I've had with every AI film I've ever watched, which is I don't give a crap about any of these characters. Yeah, I'm getting the sense of, like you said, video game cutscene. And anyone who knows me knows I'm not naysaying AI.
No, anyone I know is like super enthusiastic about like the promise of AI. But at the same time,
I look at it and I go, visual effects software can incorporate this and make the most reflective, perfect windows that look like real car windows with realistic smudges and reflections and refractions, yada, 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 and streets. And like, it's going to save VFX artists tons of time when it comes time to procedurally generate environments, blah, blah, blah. It is never, ever, ever. And I don't know. This is my prediction. By the end of this year, I think we're not going to be talking about it as like, hey, we're going to make whole movies out of this. Because I don't think that piece of it, if it ever gets there, it's not going to get there for a decade or more. And I go back to what I always think. It's like, think of a performance that really moved you. And then watch any AI performance and ask if that performance could move you at all. I think that could AI give Meryl Streep more tears and do so realistically? Probably could. Could it be Meryl Streep? I don't believe it could. The fight I will always land on is we need real writers, we need real actors, we need real cinematographers, we need real art direction, and this stuff can make that easier sometimes.
Yeah,
not really for actors, but maybe for actors. I don't know.
Hey, Ben, why don't we get to the interview?
Here we go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
Thank you so much for coming on the show and amazing, amazing work on September. Do we call it September 5 or September 5th? I keep saying September 5th.
Yeah, we call it September 5. I know it's confusing. September 5.
So, I mean, it's really an amazing and immersive film. I just kind of love that kind of, I mean, we see a lot of movies like Spotlight, where we're inside a newsroom. I don't know that I've seen so many movies, especially set like in the 70s or set early on. Makes me think of Dawn of the Dead, but different story, where we're like, in a newsroom, like real quick, just give us the elevator pitch of the movie, just so for people who haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, so September 5 is based on true events. In 1972, there was the Summer Olympics hosted in Munich, Germany, and that was the first Olympics in Germany after post-war, like during in the beginning when Hitler came to power.
Yeah.
I think it was 1936. There were the Olympics hosted in Germany was totally abused for like propaganda. So this was the Germans' attempt to like up their image in the world and be like, show how peaceful and modern and liberal they are. And that happened to be the first Olympics that were broadcast live around the world. It was like satellite television was brand new, and this was the first global event. And that's one of the reasons probably why this terrorist attack happened. Like the terrorists knew about the platform that the world is watching. And this was the first time in history that a terrorist event was broadcast live in television. And like we follow a team of ABC sportscasters, and they're there, right? They travel to Munich to report about the Olympics, about sports, and were totally unprepared for the situation when suddenly they had to switch from sports to reporting about worldwide news.
These aren't news broadcasters, yeah. they're sports broadcasters, so they kind of had to become a different kind of broadcaster kind of on the fly because there was no one else there to do it.
That's right, yeah. And so we follow them. It's pretty much what our characters say in the film. Like, we follow them wherever the story takes us. The film is very contained, so we were very strict about the perspective, what we show, what we don't show. So, like, Tim Fehlbaum, the director, he's, like, brilliant, and he was always insisting of, we can only show what our characters would have seen back then. And they were very close to the Olympic Village. Like, there was a media compound right next to the Olympic Village where all the athletes were housed. And so right next to it were the TV stations from all over the world. The media came and they had their press, like their TV studios, and where they could broadcast. And so this happened right next door, basically. But the whole media compound has no windows. It's like a TV studios. So the TV monitors become our windows to the outside world. So the information coming in, even if it happens so close, it's they hear somebody talking on a walkie-talkie, describing outside what they're seeing, somebody moving on a balcony. Then they decide to push out one of their big studio cameras outside on a hill to get a live shot of the apartment where the hostages are held. And so piece by piece, we're getting information of what's going on. And I think that's part of why it's actually such a thrilling film, is by not showing and building up the anticipation. And that's what happened back then. There was some information misreported because they didn't know. There was like no Twitter, no social media, right? Hard to imagine. Waiting for confirmed sources. They had this like wire machine, like a predecessor to a fax machine, where they're getting information from other press outlets. And like, it was such a tactile time where TV or filmmaking was so tactile. It was shot on film, or they had analog video cameras. Everything was in its infancy, right? Like, we go in great detail to show the process when, like, they have a camera team that sneaked into the Olympic Village, even if everything was sealed off by the police at some point, and they could film on 16mm what is happening. And then a runner who was like dressed up as an athlete with like a fake ID would run in and out to bring in fresh rolls of film. And they had a lab, there was a small lab on site where the TV stations could quickly develop 16mm, like within 20 minutes. I think it wasn't great quality, but within 20 minutes they could quick develop. And they put it in a telecine machine and could broadcast live. You know, there was like no film scanners, no computers, no hard drives. So everything was very analog.
And the video cameras of the day, there was no way you could take those out into the field. Like, they were all hardwired, right?
There was, for the first time, it was a very innovative Olympics, 72. They had a mobile unit, they called. There was a camera. And then they needed an assistant with a massive backpack to run around. And then a cable, somebody had to run a cable. So they could do some mobile camera workers for the first time. It was cutting edge technology for the time, but it's so interesting from today's perspective to see what went into it. And then today, right, we all have a camera and TV in our pocket, like our phones, right? We can go live.
I know, it's crazy.
On social media, but it's interesting to go back and see how that started. It also got me thinking of how we got used to it without thinking twice, but what power these images still have, right? Today we share information or pictures and videos we take ourselves, and it can go live worldwide, and it seems so normal to us.
I know, it's crazy. Yeah. It's crazy to think that we all walk around with basically a 4K camera in our pocket, yeah. and a way to distribute it instantaneously. But I mean, like, that's what's interesting, is kind of a landscape of media mm-hmm. scarcity that we were living in. I mean, honestly, until 15 years mm-hmm. ago or so, you know, even when we had the ability to take videos on our phones, they weren't that good. They haven't yeah. been that good for that long. So while I was watching it, and I knowing I was talking to you, I did not research this. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, the stuff we're seeing on the screens, how much mm-hmm. of that is archival, and how much of that did you guys recreate?
It's a mix. Actually, a large portion is recreated. So mm-hmm. whenever you see Jim McKay, the host, the ABC host, that's original archival footage, and some of the wide shots. But the majority, actually, we recreated for various reasons. Like, it was very important to everyone out of respect for the victims. We didn't want to show yeah. any of the hostages or terrorists. So this was all recreated. We had like very painstakingly, we had like the original footage as a reference, and we walked around for like many scouts with a viewfinder in the Olympic Village, which still exists today. It's like a protected heritage site. So it looks,
oh, wow,
when
really?
You point your camera in the right angles, it looks like in the 70s. If you pan too much left, right, suddenly it totally blows up. But so we found the right camera perspectives and recreated, got the costumes, got the people, even like the beginning of the film, we see that swim race with Mark Spitz. This is just to show how the media machine works. That's all recreated. The Olympic pool is still around. We had to be very careful there what to show. And at the end, it's fairly seamless. Like when the film premiered at Venice Film Festival and the first reviews came in and everybody was so excited how we used this original archival footage. I took it as a compliment, actually, that people can't tell what's new, what isn't. And I'm glad it worked out that way. And it was so important also to recreate certain scenes because we had to compress time so much. Like the real events unfolded over 22 hours. Like it was this broadcasting marathon. People were glued to the television. And we knew we had to create this sensation, right? How do we get this feeling to our audience watching this, hopefully in a movie theater or at home, over the course of 90 minutes? So we had to combine things that were spread out and tighten up. Like sometimes there would have been another hour passed, you know, until the next deadline is. We had to compress this a bit. But it's very, very authentic. We recreated everything in camera as much as possible. There's like helicopters coming at some point to fly out the hostages. And we tried to get a permit to film with a real helicopter in the Olympic Village, which is like impossible. Not even the German chancellor was allowed ever to land there.
Oh, really?
Even for like some anniversaries events there, they wouldn't be allowed. So we found this amazing hobby pilot who built a miniature helicopter. It's like actually, it's like a bigature. It's like 8 feet long that can fly, similar like a drone. It's like an RC helicopter that happened to be, he built this over the course of 10 years. He's like a hobbyist. And it happened to be the exact same model we needed, like the right lettering, the German border police helicopter from the 70s. And nobody believed me that this would work. Like we found them online. I said, like, can we just book that guy for a day and shoot instead of making this a visual effect? And then we brought him in and it worked amazingly because most of what we see from the outside world is filmed off a television screen at the end of the day. So we have a lot of, you know, you get away with a lot of analog tricks, like the same at the end when they, Marianne, the translator and her crew, they drive out to an airport to try to get footage from the shootout. And that whole airport is also a miniature, it's literally a print we put out on a field, like a couple hundred feet away from the camera. And that allowed us to shoot so gritty, you know, like it's so important for Tim and myself, the way we wanted to show this story, that it feels authentic in a moment, that you feel like we as camera operators didn't know what's going to happen, so that sometimes we like zoom in a bit late or the focus is a bit out of time, like all these little details that makes it feel, you know, not polished, not rehearsed, but in real time. And that's so important to us, and that's why it was important to get stuff in camera. Like if you shoot with a, you know, with a blue screen, usually the visual effects people ask you to shoot it, you know, more cleaner, and then we dirty it up later. And that you always feel it, right? That it's too controlled. So we try to create fabricated chaos in a way, so that as our characters are overwhelmed, like once the shots are fired and they hear there were shots fired right outdoor, like the tension goes up and up and up, and like we used every technique possible to raise the tension with, like visually, like there's so many things I've never done before. For example, when you watch documentaries from the time, like we watched so many documentaries from the 70s, there's this fantastic one about the Olympic attack. It's called One Day in September. It's like brilliant. I think it won the Academy Award. And there are many others. There's a documentary about the Apollo 11 moon landing that came out a couple of years ago. They found some old film material, I think it was 65 millimeter, which was hidden in some storage, and somebody made a documentary about it, and it looks stunning. If you see all these analog TV monitors, when they film them in a documentary, they're not perfectly synced to the camera, so they all flicker. But in Hollywood movies, you know, we go through great lengths to sync, build sync boxes or modify the TVs to run at 24 hertz to make them look perfect. And I always talked to Tim about it, like, we should embrace that flicker as a means of to create tension. And then I did some research. There's actually studies being made with rats and later humans, how light pulses affect our heart rate. Like, for example, I don't know if you remember, like, back in the day when people used to have fluorescent lighting in offices, there was articles about, like, people getting sick from bad office lighting or getting headaches, migraines. And the reason is not like the color or something, it's the flicker frequency of those tubes, that high flicker frequency. So there's these studies done that if you flicker lights between 25 hertz and 40 hertz, you can create a state of heightened alertness, and you get people's heart rate go up. And I thought, like, wait a second, like, what we're doing in a movie theater, it's a pitch black environment. If we flicker these monitors, which we use as a key light source in a dark control room, the whole image will pulse, right? And it was fascinating. Like, I drove people nuts when we shot it, because by eye it looked really crazy. Like, I synced it so it looks right on camera, on the monitors. But so as the tension gets higher and higher in certain scenes, like when we see the masked man on the balcony for the first time, for example, we dynamically ramp up the flicker frequency of our film lights. Like, we had lights hidden above that TV monitor wall that pushed more, like, artificial TV light into the room, into the director's face. And if you watch closely, luckily people don't pay attention to lighting, you know, everybody has an opinion on the actor's t-shirt or whatever, what glasses they're wearing, but nobody consciously pays attention to lighting, except maybe you and I, right? So that's what I find so fascinating about cinematography, and what we're doing is how we can subconsciously shape the mood, similar like what music does, right? I mean, with certain beats, you can affect the heart rate, and that's for the first time where we really went into this, and it was quite fascinating how well it works.
Well, I was curious, and while watching it, I think you might have just answered my question, but I could be wrong. I was wondering if the monitors, if you were doing playback through the monitors, or if, you know, I mean, like, a lot of films would just, you know, have green monitors and you'd put whatever you wanted in, you know, because, it, you know, there's reset time, yada, yada, yada. Although probably reset time is less nowadays because it's probably coming off of some kind of computer. But, like, you know, were those authentic monitors, and were you doing live playback?
Yeah, we did live playback. It was a big operation, and it's quite an uphill battle because everybody these days is used to, oh, there's a monitor, let's put a blue screen or green on, right, and we'll figure it out later. But, like, reading the script, it was always clear to us our characters are constantly interacting with what's happening on the monitor, right? Like, John Magaro's character, who plays Jeff Mason, he talks to the ABC host, Jim McKay, who's an archival, like the original Jim McKay. So we needed that playback so he can interact with him, or we have all our actors are wearing glasses. So you'd see the image they look at basically reflected, the presence of it.
Yeah. It's subtle. I didn't think about that, but yeah, you would see that.
Subtle, but it really helps that you feel, even if you have a tight close-up, you feel what actually the content they're looking at. So it was a big operation. We had an amazing team. Like, there was a playback operator hidden in the background. Whenever our actress pretended to actually, you know, go live or switch to another camera, they could push button that triggered actually something in the background. And our playback operator would make it all pop up on the analog TVs. The TV studio in our movie studio had this, well, this big old museum cameras, but one we had retrofitted with a more modern analog camera, like the original TV studio cameras from the time they had, like, this cathode, analog cathode tubes, which decay over time. They're all dead. You can't even find those tubes anymore. They're not made anymore. So we had to retrofit one. So we
put it, like, a really distinctive streak from those.
Because it's not, right, today when we talk about a video look, that's not it. It looks way more pleasing. Like, today's video look, you know, we think of sharpened electronic and compressed, you know, blocky artifacts images. But back then it was analog video. It had something gentle to it. Like you said, a streakiness, and there was not too much image processing going on because they didn't have, you know, computer chips or something. It was a, in a way, an analog, it's not like film analog, but interesting image. So we could have a live feed going from our TV studio to our monitor walls. Our actors could interact to what's happening in the TV studio next door. That was quite fun.
Well, and that actually sort of answers one of my questions as well, but I was curious how far down the rabbit hole you went getting period specific, like, you know, like were you shooting 16 millimeter film? Were you, you know, I'm guessing obviously you weren't using tube cameras because you said they don't exist, but like, was there a point where you're like, that's too much of a hassle, let's figure out how, let's fake that part of this in post?
We shot on every possible medium and camera. Like early on, we discussed we shoot everything on film because it's 70s, and then we did tests in pre-production, and I knew that the monitors is that they're the key to, right, the window to the outside world. So I want our characters to be like glued to the TV. The TVs have to be the brightest spot in the scene, and that they should feel like the main light source. And then we did tests. We did a little monitor setup in a dark room, and I tested 60 millimeter film, 35 millimeter film, 500 ASA stock. We pushed it a stop and compared digital cameras. And then once in a while, something really magical happened on film, how it reacts to that bluish TV light. But most of it didn't look good. We would have had to use way more artificial film lighting to create the illusion that the light comes from the TV, when in fact it comes from an off angle. And it would have looked more like a film shot in the 70s. And we didn't really want to do that. Like, you know, this, like, I think it's important to convey a feel of the period, but we also wanted it to feel like relevant for today and have something modern. So we decided actually to shoot the majority digital. We shot on a Red V Raptor for the majority. For the archival footage, we used some Super 16 to match some of the original archival footage. But that's also a mix of many of those scenes were shot digital. We shot on an old Red Helium, which has a smaller sensors, and I windowed it down to like the smallest 2K sensor crop and used the highest compression. You know, Red cameras can compress the image internally, and the highest ISO setting to really mess up the image as much as possible. And what came out, and then we had a feed to our analog TV wall, and what came out looked pretty much like a standard def camera from back in the time, which is interesting because it's an 8K sensor made in, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago. That's what we used.
I love the phrase, an old Red Helium. Like, you know, to me it still sounds like kind of new.
A vintage sensor, you know. I mean, for the majority on the sound stages, we used the Red V Raptor, but there too we mixed different lenses and formats. Like we were, like Tim was very inspired by Natural Born Killers, you know, which a film that
I was going to ask about that, but I was thinking about that, but I didn't, you know, because in terms of like Natural Born Killers, almost feels like a weird extension of this, where this is like the beginning of the media being so at the center of things, and Natural Born Killers is like the media's gotten so distorted and has soaked up all of its own self-importance, and this is like the media realizing what it can do.
And Red Natural Born Killers, it's amazing how like Bob Richardson, how they mix black and white color and grainy Super 8, like just cut to the next shot, and it's amazing the richness it creates, right? And
I love
your eyeballs.
I love that movie. I love that movie, and I love that period of Robert Richardson. Also, like Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, the Errol Morris documentary that he shot.
Super bold, right? Super bold. That is really inspiring, and
it's not being afraid to make. Yeah. And it makes sense for this film, but it's not being afraid to let the jarring change of the image source become like to distract the audience, to like make you very aware that you're watching several different sources at once.
That was, I think, an inspiration for this too. We talked about it with Tim and our producers, and that our topic is the media, right? And that event was covered, it was a, like September 5, 72, this was covered from all angles. The ABC yeah. crew was the only ones who had a live image. They would beam around the world, but it was like, you know, press coverage. There was local TV stations shooting 16 millimeter. All this stuff came out later. And when you watch the documentaries, you feel all this flood of images. And we thought, like, how can we recreate a sensation that it's not just this one angle? And so we actually mixed spherical zoom lenses and all like very old lenses from the 70s that were actually used to shoot the Olympics. And then when the tension goes really high, we switch to anamorphic primes. So every time the tension goes high, because I always feel like, you know, the stretched vertical bokeh of an anamorphic lens creates tension in the image. It's something, again, very subconscious, but in the right context, you feel the tension in the air, literally. You know, people always pay attention to what's in focus, but if you watch a film on a big screen in a theater, you know how it is, the focus is on the actor's eyes, but 80% of your field of view is out of focus. So how that bokeh feels or makes you feel, I think, is so important. And that's why like, I'm a big lens buff, like testing lenses all the time. I started a couple years ago, like there's this lens testing database, if you want to discover lenses, it's called Cineflares. It's like cineflares.com, it's like a library of hundreds of cine lenses, which we shot with motion control to compare them. It started with just lens flares, now we're testing all kinds of stuff. And through that testing over the years, I found so many unique lenses, like sometimes it's still lenses or old zoom lenses you can buy on eBay for $50. And I said, wow, why can't we have this in a cinema lens, right? Like most lenses these days are fairly clean and sharp and big and heavy. So we used a very old lens. It's called the Zoomar, which is actually the first ever zoom lens made for stills photography. And it happened to be made in Munich. It's an amazing story. The lens designer, he was a Jewish German who escaped during World War II to New York, but he kept his ties to like this lens company in Munich. So after the war, they co-designed this lens. It's called Zoomar. It has a very odd range. It's, I think, 36 millimeter to 82. It's an f2.8, so pretty fast. And it was the first zoom lens ever made for full frame. And it's unbelievable how good it looks still today. They got so much right. It was, you know, done before there was computer lens designs. It was all manually calculated. It looks so good. So we bought two of those off eBay and we had them PL mounted so we could use them handheld. There's now professionally rehoused versions too. And then we used other zoom lenses, which actually I detuned myself. I cannot recommend it. Don't try this at home.
That always sounds scary to me, the idea of taking a lens apart. Like I wouldn't even know what I was looking at.
Yeah, it's one thing with a prime lens, but with a zoom lens, it's a whole different ballgame. And I, like through those testings with the Cineflares library, I sometimes see, wow, this lens has something magical. Just as the light source exits the frame and like something magical is happening, what is this? So I knew from which lenses do this, what lens group might be the reason for it. So I bought a set of zoom lenses and I said like, okay, these are mine, I can mess with them. I will take them apart and I did like everything. Like,
oh my God.
Certain lens elements you can, if they're symmetric enough, you can turn them around 180 degrees. So you get a bit more of edge softness. And then I did towards the rear group, between two lens, like, you know, there's air gaps, what they call air gaps between lens elements. And I put a fine layer of dust, because I always, when you look at old vintage lenses, they not only have a soft contrast, they sometimes have really dust enclosed into it. And if you whatever it is, 2.8.5 or even T4, sometimes you feel it out of focus.
Whoa.
And I think it's beautiful in a film like September 5, you know, which is about this tactile thing. And then we did the center, though, I cleaned out again, so it's towards the edge of the frame, and that created a really interesting halation effect. And then I put everything, like fingerprints. There was
really
a lot of testing. And I was really
how many elements are in one of these lenses?
It's like 12 to, or even more, 12 to 20 elements. But so I was really happy with what I saw and how it looked like. And
but
then,
like, how do you, I mean, I apologize, yeah. I don't mean to interrupt, but how do you even have the thought of like, okay, what if I put my thumbprint on just this one yeah. element of the 12? Like, how do you know what each element is doing and which ones would be best to do that on? Are you, when you take it apart, are you able to feed an image through it somehow and see what yeah. you're monkeying no, around is doing?
I had to always put it back together. That was the challenge. And I basically when you manipulate the elements close towards the front, you the look will change quite significantly because it's a zoom lenser. So as you zoom, you're using a different part of the lens, versus the deeper yeah. you go, especially behind the iris, it's more consistent. But I found if you only do it behind the iris, it looks a bit two-dimensional. So that that's the beauty of a zoom lens that has so many elements. If you spread it out, especially like fingerprints at the edges of the frame, you get a three-dimensional look. Like when we have light sources, all these light sources on September 5 had to be like integrated into the set because we shot with two cameras, 360. And then sometimes I knew we would get those light sources in and then you feel this bloom quality, but it's not just like a front filter, bloom filter, because it's spread out through those lens elements. Like as the camera moves and we zoom, there's some really interesting quality to it. But like, that's why I'm saying don't try this at home. But the tricky part, like I said, I had to put it back together and it doesn't take long to take a lens apart, but put it back together. It took me the entire day and I'm like, oh my God, I was like sweating. I had so little prep time on that film because I came straight from another TV show. I shot the pilot and I came and had literally only 2 weeks of prep for September 5. Like I was attached.
Oh, wow.
I was attached to the film for I think 3 years. We talked about it many times. There was attempts to have it financed. So we scouted the Olympic Village several times.
You've made several films with the same director.
Yeah, that's our third collaboration. So we had a great shorthand, but I knew from wrapping that one project to actually filming September 5 out of 2 weeks. So every day was super precious, and like one day I completely lost by trying to put those lenses back together. And then at some point I got it back together. It's all fine, but still it was too stiff. I couldn't zoom it anymore. And I went to we had a fantastic rental house. It was Airy in Munich. They supported us with all the camera gear, and we had some like the cameras and other all the accessories from them. And I gave it to the boss at Airy Rental, Manfred Jahn. He's like a lens genius. He's like, can you help with this? And he's like, oh yeah, I'll be back in 5 minutes. He was literally, it was like 10 minutes and he came back and the thing was like brand new. I don't know how they did it. It took me almost the entire day to get it back together, and they jump. And then it was like a brand new lens. Like, so all these artifacts are in between those lens groups, but the whole mechanics felt like new. And I think that was the solution why we could also shoot so fast. We had, I think, about 27 days on stage where we shot all the interior in the Olympic Village, and then a couple days where we went for the exteriors on the Olympic site. So we had to be very fast and shooting with zoom lenses. We had a wide one and a tight one for A and B camera. And this allowed us to be so intuitive and react to the performances.
Did you operate on the film?
Yeah, usually on bigger films, right, with operators. And here I knew this is so intimate. This is such a confined space. It was almost like shooting in a submarine. I knew yeah. I had to be in there, and some things you cannot explain, right? That you want to maybe zoom in at a certain moment. So I operated A camera, and my longtime camera operator, Stefan Sosner, he was on B cam, and we were a great tag team. Sometimes the director would also jump in. He's also very visual. Like he started out shooting documentaries himself as a director and cinematographer. And we did. What's quite unique about it, we talked about it in prep for a long time. How do we get this sensation of life that our audience watching this film today, right, feels like the audience in the 70s being glued to their TVs and like what's going to happen yeah. next? So we thought, should we shoot the whole film as a one take film? You know, what films like Birdman, for example, where there's no visible cuts and then they stitch scenes together, so it looks like a continuous take, but then we also felt like, well, then we're forcing our audience to walk down a corridor, filming the back of an actor's head, walking from A to B for a minute that feels maybe like 20 minutes in the film, you know? So we knew.
But also like that, I mean, like in 1917 or Birdman, that's part of the language of the movie. But with this, I feel like that would feel like a parlor trick. Like like you made it feel very immersive, like we were really there with you.
Yeah, so we knew editing is so important, right? This is about the media. So we decided to shoot everything as oneers. Like every scene was covered, like it was mastered from beginning to end with two cameras. But we knew it would be tightened up with editing. And I think that's what makes the tension so intense. Like we always said, like, we have one attempt to capture everything that's happening in that scene. So like I would start maybe with a wide shot. John McGarrow's character would storm into the control room. Then I would walk up into a close up and he points at the TV and then a snap zoom onto the TV wall. Getting all those pieces, including inserts, everything. And knowing that we had two cameras, we're a great tag team. I always would see where Stefan, he sees where I am. So we tried to capture this. We never rehearsed, like the rehearsal was the first take we shot, right? It was,
oh, really?
Sometimes really magical stuff happens before you start repeating. And then we did a couple more takes. And then what's so unique about
you're talking camera rehearsal, not actor rehearsal.
Both. Like the actor, I mean, they talked it through a bit in pre-production, but we always try to capture that first attempt of, because it, like we talk about trying fabricating chaos. What, like we had this, the real John McGarrow, who's played by, the real Jeff Mason played by John McGarrow. He was consulting on the project, so he was in the control room in 72, and he told us, everything moved so fast, they had no time to think, and what can we show, can we show somebody being shot on live television? Like, there was not much time to think about it, they were just, the events happened so fast, they were just trying to get the cameras out and tell that story. So we had to create the same sensation of overwhelming our actors, right, with information, and like somebody's like almost like a surprise storming into the building and then not being prepared for this versus, making it feel too rehearsed. Like we never had, let's cut and set up for a wide shot and we mark out with tape marks for the actors. You stand here and change the lighting. We never did this. We in the morning I came in and I try to light the space as good as possible, obviously knowing they will look here at the monitors and know somebody will stand here in the door frame in a dark corner. So I tried to light this as good as possible. And then we just went and covered the whole scene. And that's where a lot of magic happens, which you cannot plan. There's so many details. And actually talking to the actors afterwards, they were so immersed into it, they completely forgot about us and that we were there filming them. Like actually, I just heard Peter Sarsgaard talking about it, that sometimes, you know, in certain types of films, when you have these precise marks and there's maybe a piece of tape stuck to the mat box for the actor to perform to the camera instead of looking into their counterpart, into their eyes. And he described it as like feeding your performance into the tube, you know, like the camera being the tube, and like you're not really into it, versus what we did felt way more like a theater stage play to them. They completely were in there. There was no, you know, cutting or doing a
pick-up. Well, yeah, not having to think about the lighting. And, you know, I mean, you know, the inside of a newsroom like this or a studio, you know, is not meant to be flattering to the people inside the studio. Yeah. So the fact that they're going to be going in and out, you know, in and out of light, you know, like adds to the realism and verisimilitude of the whole thing. So that does sound cool. I often wonder when I'm on set, I don't know. I once was doing second unit for a director who like was like, the director came over while I was doing it and was futzing with the eyeline tape and moving it by inches. And I was like, is that supposed to be my job, is to figure out like exactly where on the mat box you're supposed to look? I feel like it's, like I agree. I feel like it adds to like a weird kind of artificiality to everything when what you really want is connection.
I mean, there's always the right moment maybe to do this, but if you constantly do this,
it's good to have every technique, obviously.
if you constantly do this, then right, you feel, I think the actors are not as immersed into the moment.
You want them thinking about it. And I mean, like, obviously, if you're making something that's like super precision lighting or something like that, and they really have to hit the marks, I guess I get it. And I love those things that have that kind of high style.
Yeah.
But something like this, where you just kind of feel like you're there, but it doesn't feel like it lacks for style. It doesn't feel like it doesn't, like, that becomes the vibe and the style, and it's a period thing. And I don't know if it was more of a grade or partly production design, but like, there's a certain kind of color look that you go for that immediately cues me and it makes me think like, this is the 70s. And I guess a lot of that must've been about the lenses, but was there anything around like the LUTs that you were using or any of that stuff?
It's combination of all these things. A lot has to do with the lighting, actually. Like, I know it make it sound like we just went in there and shot 360 day and night, but it was the most challenging film I've ever done, but at the same time was also creatively so liberating, because we were, like I mentioned before, it felt like shooting in a submarine. So there was this small group of people. Some of them were my friends from film school. I went to film school in Munich years ago, and then I moved to LA, and coming back all these years later and working with my friends, and we started out making films, like Tim, the director, and some of the producers.
Did you go to film school with him?
He's a bit older, so I never really met him as a student, but when he graduated, that's when we met, and I helped him for his graduation project, and then I filmed his debut feature. So we go back quite a bit and developed, I think, this sensibility of how a certain handheld camera, yet without what, you don't want people to think, oh, this is a shaky cam or something. Like, it has to feel just right following what's happening in front of the camera. And so with the lighting, I knew, like, this I wanted it to feel like it's from a period, but also it should feel present and not like actually watching a film from the 70s. So I decided to go for like a fluorescent lighting look for the entire studio complex. You know, there's like office space and corridors, editing bay, the TV studio. And so we put in old fixture housings that for fluorescent tubes, but all the tubes themselves are modern LED lights. So we used Astera tubes everywhere. I said, like, because I knew we have so little time, we have to be fast, and I want to do quite interesting stuff with the dimmer board and flicker effects. Let's make everything Astera tubes, because those have individual pixels and you could program them. But I always find, you know, when you watch something that's shot on a soundstage, you can tell it feels too polished, too static, the lighting is too controlled, right? Not lived in. And old fluorescent tubes, for example, they always have some life to them. If you remember, towards the ends, they flicker a little bit. It's just a little flip just at the ends where they mounted. And then some have different color variations. So with those LED tubes, we programmed individual pixels to flicker a bit, like very subtle.
Oh, wow.
It's super subtle, and then you have a corridor with like hundreds of lights. And this all adds up to takes away the sterile, you know, stage feel. And then what I mentioned, what we did with the TV monitors, like in that control room, when the tension gets high, they flicker. The same we did also, for example, in the main corridor, when like Peter Sarsgaard is like storming through the corridor with a piece of information, which is a big surprise. We have those. It's always the flicker was always on a fader, and my board operator could adjust, depending on the tension, adjust the overall flicker frequency. When you watch the film with like the grainy look and everything, it's hard to put your finger on it, but it really does something to the tension.
No, that's really, really cool. It's funny, because when I was watching it, it felt like you were in a real studio, and that was, I did enough research to know that you shot that stuff on a stage, but I bought it, but it also felt like maybe the way David Fincher has been known to approach small spaces, like it didn't feel like there were fly walls and the camera could be anywhere. It felt like the camera could only be where it could be in that room.
Yeah, that's right. It was so important for us. Even if we had to build it on a soundstage, we looked everywhere, because the exterior Olympic Village, like I mentioned, is a heritage site that still exists and we could shoot there. But the TV studio complex, which was right next to it, that was all demolished a couple of years ago. So we had to build it on a stage. But we made sure with Julian Wagner, our production designer, and Tim and I, we planned out all those scenes in advance. We like taped out on a soundstage, literally with gaff tape and paper tape, where would be the rooms, the corridors, so we could connect all those pieces. I used my iPad with a viewfinder app to walk long before we started building, because we wanted this feel of that the audience understands this is happening right outside their door, even if there's no windows. Yeah. So John McGarro's character arrives in his car and he walks in, like there's no cut, we walk with him from the parking lot.
What is the viewfinder app, by the way?
It's like, it's called Kadrage. I usually use it, very simple viewfinder app. You can get different lenses, you know, like a director's viewfinder.
So you know what lens you're
getting. Yeah.
I thought it might have been some virtual thing where you were seeing.
No, super low tech. And we used like people from the office would stand in and because there's some, because it's a historic film, right? We couldn't show certain areas or just pointing the camera in a certain direction would require visual effects cleanups. And we were also an independent production. We had a very limited budget, not much time. So this was super helpful to show people, because for me as a cinematographer, I was now, you know, the shallow depths of field, we're focusing on the actors. We whip pan with somebody as he gets out of the car. We don't really have to worry about that background too much, but for most people in a production meeting, it's hard to imagine. They think, oh yeah, we see the world, we have to paint it out, or we have to add some buildings that are period accurate. So by shooting that, like at Todd Tess at night, at the right time of day with a, like some PAs or office PAs walked it, and we could see what works, what doesn't work, and I could have, like with Tim, discuss, is it okay we stay tight for this quick moment and then we walk into the soundstage, and that avoids adding too many visual effects, which we couldn't have afforded, but also maybe would have created an artifice that doesn't feel like it belongs to that film.
So one question that popped into my head when you were talking about the rehearsal thing, and I don't know if you would know the answer to this. This might be a director and editor question, but how many of those first unrehearsed takes do you think made the cut?
That's a good question. I think there's many. It was a puzzle, I think, to get this all together, but many first takes were, there was some magic stuff happening, and we found some good energy, and then we repeated it a couple more times. But usually we saw the first take happening, and when we did it several times with slight modifications, maybe I positioned myself in a different part of the room. But I think what's actually most interesting at the end, every time we felt like we captured the scene, Tim said, like, I think we got it. And he looked at his watch and was like, we still have a couple minutes. And he said, let's go one more time, and we do what he called wild style. And this is where then literally everything was allowed. Like, he told the actress in the middle of the scene, if you feel like walking down outside to the corridor or go check out and talk to some background extra sitting in the background, like just go for it, you know? And we would follow them what happens. And I think this was a real challenge for our editor, like Hans Jörg.
Oh my God, brilliant. Continuity.
And but that's why it was so brilliant from Tim to be so brave, because we knew we have the scene in the can. Let's go one time really
Did a lot of that wild stuff make the cut?
I think pieces here and there. I would have to ask Hans-Jörg and Tim, but I recognize some things, like sometimes the energy with how somebody's like, you know, pushing a button on the video mixer and what speaks into the microphone, because I knew we have the scene, I don't have to play it safe, I could really move with them and, you know, like crash zoom into as I speak with a mouthpiece into the microphone. There's some really interesting things happen.
That's so cool.
Wild
style. That's awesome. gotta remember that. Let's do a wild style one. Well, we're coming up on your time here. So the movie is it still in theaters, or is it, because I think it's starting to stream on the 17th of January, if I'm not mistaken.
So there's a limited release in theaters right now, only in New York, LA, and Toronto, but on the 17th of January, there's a wide release, theatricals. It's only theatrical for now. maybe whenever people listen to this, maybe it will stream at some point.
I have no idea what our schedule is for stuff gets released. It could be released next week. I don't know. We just did the wraps for today's episode this morning.
Yeah.
So.
And yeah, it's amazing. I actually watched this morning. I had to do a sign off on a DCP. We did a Dolby Cinema, a Dolby Vision master for certain theaters. And I've seen the film so many times, but it's such a fast-paced movie. It's 91 minutes. The moment the tension starts cooking, it goes. It's
good
really
on you guys for doing that, by the way. Like I feel like there are so many movies, and nothing wrong with a long movie, but I've seen so many movies that are 3.5-4 hours long lately, and it's like, to me, 90 minutes is a great compact time.
So that's amazing. I hope people can watch it and catch it in the theater, and if not, maybe at home. But it's really, if you like the 70s or are interested in media and journalism, and especially today, right? Like this is a never, like our film is really about the media and how, like this happened to be that terrorist event, but it just shows you a bit how things work and how the questions people ask themselves. And also maybe for us as a viewer or consumer of news, how much is almost like entertainment, right? Like this is real world happening.
It's complete, like you said, like the Natural Born Killers thing.
Yeah.
Like, it's like we flipped over we've gone through the looking glass on that, and we're on the other side of it, being like, why shouldn't news entertain me?
Yeah.
And, you know,
it's interesting to step back, right, and see how that all started. And that's why so many people don't know about it. I mean, the 72 of these events, like there was Spielberg's movie Munich, right, which is a brilliant film, but this tackles more the aftermath, like I think the revenge story of finding the people behind that attack.
Yeah, it's versus more like a spy movie kind of thing.
Whereas our film, you're right there in real time. That's why it's so interesting. A lot of like young people came up to me after screenings and they had no idea this happened, and it's so interesting. And you know, growing up with TikTok and like going back and showing analog tape machines and what they went through.
That would be so weird. What would TikTok have been like there? Yeah. Anyway, well, cool. So before we go, where can people find your work online, or, you know, if you have an Instagram or a TikTok that you want to plug?
TikTok, not on TikTok yet, but yeah, I'm on Instagram.
Me neither.
Not there yet, one day. You can find me at Marcus Forderer, my name. If you have any cinematography questions, I will try to answer them. Shoot me a message.
Like on Instagram?
On Instagram, yeah. And then I have this lens passion project also on Instagram. It's called Cineflares. If you're interested to learn about lenses, it's a really cool like online database with hundreds of lens tests.
I'm totally checking. I am kind of looking at it while I'm talking to you. So
awesome.
Well, cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, and I hope people check out September 5, man. It's a really cool film, and you know, it's a crowded marketplace of really cool movies. I hope that it's able to kind of rise above and get some attention, because it certainly deserves it.
Thank you so much, Ben. It was really fun chatting to you.
All right, so that was Marcus Forderer. Hey, thank you so much for being on the show. Great to have you on. And
please come back.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Ben, it is time to pay the bills. It is time when we thank one of our fine sponsors. Today, we have to thank our sponsor, Aputure, maker of all kinds of lighting equipment. You know, Aputure, I think, might best be known for sort of this more entry-level product that, you know, was relatively inexpensive and offered a lot of performance. But I want to talk today about their high-end products, particularly the ElectroStorm CS15. The ElectroStorm CS15 is an incredible light source. Now, I've already heard people say like, oh, well, that came out last year, it's got to be obsolete. Not at all. It issues a tremendous...
How sad is it that something that came out last year should be obsolete? I'm just saying.
Yes, it is a 1500-watt color-tunable white light that matches brightness of 1800-watt HMIs, which... Anyone who knows about 1800 watt HMIs, they know that that's actually putting out a lot more output than the watts would have you believe. HMIs are super efficient. And the fact that you're getting better than HMI, 1800 watt HMI output from this light, and it's in a smaller size with a relatively small ballast, and It can be plugged
less
into
less heat, I assume.
Way less heat, and then a tremendous amount of attachments that go with it. Look, it's not cheap. It's about a $7,000 light. This is an expensive light, but I am seeing it on real productions used by real studios.
I mean, compared to how much would the equivalent HMI run you? I mean, like just the freaking lamp for the HMI.
Well, they can cost you quite a bit. But what's interesting is, though, is that quite a lot of those lights are now actually getting fairly cheap. They're, the used market is overflowing with them. And I've seen them go now for less money than the new Electrostorm. But that's not the point here. And then really not the type of thing that there's all kinds of drawbacks to traditional sort of HMI technology, of which the Electrostorm CS15 has none, including not fragile. Not, you know, this thing takes a knock, you don't have to worry about your expensive bulb being shattered, and it runs for a very, very, very long time. It's quite quiet, and it is built really tough. It is a tough, hardened system, and it has all kinds of cool accessories to go with it. Plus, it's got the built-in Cytus link, so you can control it. You can control it via, you know, a wireless DMX. The CS15 is an amazing light, and if you are in the market for a premier, top-end, high-quality, extreme output HMI replacement, it's worth looking at the Electrostorm CS15. I know it is in stock at Hot Rod Cameras in Burbank. So, of course, hit up Hot Rod Cameras if you're interested in checking it out. Anyway, Ben, it is our time for our short ends.
And now, short ends.
It's the time when we talk about our pet obsession of the week. It's the time we, you know, it could be anything. What is your pet obsession this week?
It's something I've been meaning to plug for a while. It's a podcast called Let's Shoot with Pete Chatman. And it is a podcast about directing. It's kind of like what we do, but for directing. And it's also a lot like how we did it when we started, which is to say there aren't that many episodes. And he hasn't put one out since August, by my reckoning here. He might be working, but he's a working TV director. And if you quickly go through it, it has great advice for anyone who's looking to be mostly a TV director. There's an episode that I really loved called it was 10 Commandments for Episodic Directors. And it just kind of goes through what you need to be thinking about to land these jobs. Hasn't gotten me any jobs as an episodic director, but hey, it's still it's a really cool podcast, and I think for people who listen to our podcast, they might find it to be a very useful resource.
That sounds awesome. All right, Ben, I think that just about does it for this episode. Where can people find you if they want to track you down?
Please find me at benrock.com. Also, I've been all over Blue Sky, Neptune Salad at Blue Sky, and some people from the show, listeners to the show, have been reaching out to say howdy. Please say hi. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
Can find me over at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. Also, LinkedIn. A couple of people connected with me from LinkedIn who mentioned the show this week. So, yeah, you can find me there.
I get those, too, and I always appreciate it.
All right. So, Ben, who do we have to thank this week? Who made this show possible?
Well, firstly, Michael Indispensable Dispenza. Oh, my God, am I going all fetch on that. Mike Dispenza, who is editing the episodes and hopefully making us sound erudite and concise, which neither of us are.
Ooh, thank you for pulling erudite out. That's like a 25-cent word. Well done.
Yeah. I have a bachelor's degree from a college in Florida. So nice. There you go.
Was it a very erudite college?
University of Central Florida. I don't think anyone's ever
referred to as erudite.
Erudition is not our specialty in Florida in general. We got to thank Kay Zalatracci, who composed every scrap of music on here. And then I saved her for last because we love her the most. Alana Cody, our producer, who's kicking all the ass on earth. And we just did some pretty awesome interviews last week. Like, I landed from out of town and was immediately interviewing people, and so are you. And I've got another one coming up this week that I think is going to be a serious contender for the Oscars. So nice. Thank you, Alana, for all the work you do. You're the best.
Yes, indeed. All right. So, Ben, that just about does it for us. I took us out last time. Do you want to take us out?
Thanks for tuning in.
Well done. You did that without a sense of irony. It's really catching on. It's really good.
Between the two of us, yeah.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.